This episode of the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters podcast is brought to you by the Podbean podcast app. The Podbean podcast app is the top available podcast app around. You can get instant updates of my new podcasts or others that you listen to directly to your app. It's free, easy to use, and gives you all the features you need to help discover new podcasts and even create your own. Whether you use an Android or iPhone device, this app is the podcast app for you. Get the Podbean podcast app now on Google Play or Apple's App Store and start enjoying more from the podcast that you love. Welcome to the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters podcast. My name is Kieran Pedley. And unfortunately for you unlucky viewers, we're not in the flesh this week. It's an audio-only podcast. To be honest, I'm off on my holidays this week and trying to get everything desperately done. But I did want to speak about some polling findings this week. Polling doesn't stop because of my holidays. And I'm grateful to be joined by a couple of guests who are going to talk about some of the issues of the day. I'm joined by Don Brind, former BBC political correspondent and Labour press officer, also a regular contributor to PoliticalBetting.com, as many of the listeners to this podcast will know, and now we're doing some work with Saving Labour, which he's going to be talking about on this show. Don, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
And returning to the podcast, Harry Carr, head of Sky Data and political analyst at Sky News. Harry, welcome back.
Hello, nice to be here.
So, as people that have been listening to the podcast will know in the past sort of few weeks, we've changed the format up a little bit. So each guest brings their topic that they'd like to talk about. It could be polling related specifically, or it might be something elections related. And then we debate some of those issues that arise. And Don, from your work with Saving Labour, you come up with a maybe unconventional view, sort of challenging the conventional wisdom on Jeremy Corbyn's so-called inevitable victory in Labour's leadership contest, haven't you? So maybe you want to explain to the listeners a bit about what you've been finding.
Yeah, I've been boring for Britain a bit for the last few weeks. When I read in various papers, you know, Corbyn is the favourite, which is true in bookies terms, but, you know, he's got huge support amongst membership. And I said, where's the evidence? We've had one poll of a very difficult to sample group when we didn't know what the electorate was going to be. We now know that there are going to be over 640,000 people voting in this election. And a key part of that is 120,000 people recruited directly through Saving Labour who are anti-Corbyn supporters, so 20% of the total. Now, the key thing about this is Corbyn won, his win was as big as it was last time because his side managed to recruit lots of the three quidders, you know, the registered supporters. Now, it's 25 quid now, but nonetheless, 120,000-odd people have signed up, and 70,000 plus of those came through Saving Labour. An additional 50,000 came in the affiliated trade union section. So we've got 120,000 people who are new, and I think that's a game changer. And the analysis that we've come out with today says this is too close to call. You know, we're talking 3,000 between the two candidates.
Well, let's unpick some of those numbers in more detail. For the benefit of the people listening who maybe haven't seen some of the numbers that Saving Labour have published today, I don't want to go into too much complexity on an audio show, but what it seems to be, looking at the different sort of components of the Labour electorate, is that even with Saving Labour's numbers, you're sort of conceding to some extent that the membership seems to be going 60-40 approximately towards Jeremy.
Yeah.
But what you're sort of saying is that the registered supporters and the trade union affiliates are approximately going 60-40 the other way. I mean, you've mentioned the recruiting from Saving Labour, but how can you be confident about that with the registered supporters and trade union affiliates? Because if we look at last time, a year ago, looking at the affiliated supporters, about 57% of them went for Jeremy Corbyn. Registered supporters went 84% for Jeremy Corbyn. Now, different people, as you said, but how can you be sort of confident that Saving Labour have got these numbers?
OK, it's really crucial that you understand all those people, their registrations expired. They're no longer there. So what we have now is a completely new set of people who signed up in these two ways as affiliated or as registered supporters who paid the money. And we know because of digital tracking that people started at Saving Labour and got to the Labour Party. Now, we can't prove that they then actually did the deed, but we think it's a reasonable assumption that most of them did. What you need to see is that there's some phasing here. Up to 2015, there was a, I think the number, you know, we have a 200,000 members. After the general election, but before the cutoff date, another 150,000 people joined. Now, we say we accept Momentum's claims that the vast majority of that segment post-general election are Corbyn supporters. We buy that, and we, you know, our calculations are based on that. But then came the other phase of recruitment through Saving Labour, which was set up in May, and we think our figures on that side are robust. The trade union ones, are, I think, are very interesting because they targeted areas where there are doubts about the Corbyn industrial strategy, defence being most obvious, but also steel, where he doesn't have a glittering road. So some very well-directed targeting there. And if you look at the polling that there has been on trade union members, actually they're against Corbyn. He doesn't do well, even though you know, the leaderships of the unions may have signed up. Actually, the members are anti-Corbyn.
I'll bring Harry in at this stage. Harry, welcome back to the show again. This sounds encouraging for people that maybe support Owen Smith, but at the same time, I suppose it is a huge ask to get, you know, a 60-40 split in the favour of the sort of registered supporters or trade union affiliates, isn't it?
Well, I think what this does is show a potential path that maybe you could see that Smith can possibly win it, which is something which for a lot of people they haven't quite been able to see. How would this ever actually happen? I must say that I think that for a lot of people, I'd be surprised if the registered supporters are all new different people. A lot of them, I would suspect, are likely to be the same people who have come back again. Although there isn't any we don't actually have complete evidence.
No, but I mean, I do think if they were registered supporters last time round, I think there was a big effort by Momentum to convert them into members, and that's where the 150,000 who we concede are strong Corbyn supporters may well have gone. So they stopped being registered supporters, but they became Labour Party members at the behest of Momentum.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that I'd say is that, so for the trade unions, for example, I know that there's some polling by YouGov and election data in Ian Warren, which showed that actually trade unions from a variety of sources were just about in favour of Owen Smith, but only just. But following on from that, that was kind of backed up by the GMB, but not by Unite, which had their own consultation and actually ended up endorsing Jeremy Corbyn. So I think
think Unite did any kind of...
Unite or Unison?
It was Unison.
Unison, sorry.
Unison who did a sort of branch consultation.
Yes.
And they, you know, produced numbers in favour of Jeremy. Yeah. Unite did it all, you know, top down.
Yes. I think basically what this shows is that it's possible that Smith could win. Like, it's a nice sort of intellectual way of looking at it to say, how could you try and go about winning if you are on Owen Smith's team? Who are you going to try and target? And it's really interesting to sort of find out the sort of stuff that Saving Labour have been trying to do in terms of who they've been trying to target.
Can I just offer an analogy here? In the last election, if you're a Labour supporter, we were out there and we had 4 million conversations, whatever the quality of those are. We were having a fantastic ground war, we thought. But then below the radar, Jim Messina and Lyndon Crosby and the whole gang were doing some very effective social media targeting. And I think I don't want to stretch the analogy too far, but I think there is what Saving Labour has done is akin to, or is analogous to what happened in that election. So it was a terrible shock that, you know, the exit poll night. I think, he said, sticking his neck out, Jeremy Corbyn is in for a terrible shock. Or could be.
Okay, what do you make of the CLP nominations? I know you've been on record on this, because, you know, if I look at some of the numbers here, just a cursory glance, Jeremy Corbyn took 152 out of 387 of the CLP nominations last time, obviously four candidates, very different context of the race, so around 40% of the CLP nominations, whereas right now he's got, I mean, this is real data that we do have, 84% of CLP nominations. That would suggest, at least amongst the membership, that, you know, which is maybe a separate separate point, Jeremy Corbyn looks very, very strong. I mean, you've challenged this, haven't you?
Yeah, well, I think the two things. What it's telling you is this is where Momentum have put their effort. I don't think it tells you much more than that. When you look at the real numbers of real people who took part in this, a couple of examples. In Canterbury, Jeremy won, I think, 91-8. Fantastic. Landslide. How many members does Canterbury Labour Party have? 1,500. So the turnout is, what's the math? You know, 100 over, you know, it's not even
10.
Yeah, it's 1/15. Yeah, I can't do that. You know, and then Camden Labour Party, even more stark. 270 to 180 for Jeremy. Wow, another big win. How many members does Camden have? 5,000. And if you look at top them all up, which has been done, you get something like about 30,000 people took part in this. Hmm. A very self-selecting sample. And what's the selectorate? It's 600,000. So this actually, I don't think, tells you anything about the balance of opinion in the Labour Party. It just tells you where Momentum have put their effort.
I suppose on the other hand, so I think that Stephen Bush was saying this earlier, that I think it's predicted previously back to 1992. But there are some other sides of that. I think
not many contests between 1992 and now, I suppose, would be the devil's advocate argument, right?
Yeah,
yeah, so and none of them were, you know, where recruitment was part of the picture, and it was just it was either MPs or it was the membership. This time we've got this model introduced by Ed Miliband, where bringing people in is a key part of the campaign. Momentum did it spectacularly well last time, and I would argue that they've been beaten at their own game this time. That will look, I think, when we come to analyse this, we'll say that was the story. Wow, Momentum, they talked a good fight.
There is also, I suppose, the idea that there's been lots of accusations of intimidation by Corbynite supporters, and that you're therefore less likely to see people A, voting for Smith in the CLPs, and two, actually turning up in the first place.
Well, I think how that, you know, one way that could play is it people don't turn up at meetings, but it doesn't mean they don't vote.
Yeah.
And I think the booing of Sadiq Khan, you know, was bad in itself. I think Jeremy Corbyn could stop it just by holding his finger up and say, we don't do that in the Labour Party. And it's shameful that he didn't. But actually, I think it's hurting him. I think there are, you know, people in the middle who say, that's, you know, if that's Corbyn's leadership style, I don't want it.
I think what we haven't actually talked about at all, though, is Owen Smith, really, and his supporters, which I think there is a sort of worry for people who would be on the centre-left, the Blairite or moderate or whatever you want to call it, element of the Labour Party, which is that what happened last time was there wasn't a huge amount of inspiration on the not-Corbyn side. Mm. People looked at all of the other candidates and said that they're not going to be Prime Minister. I may as well go for the full fat rather than Diet Coke sort of analogy. But then there's the question is Smith actually any more of an advance on Andy Byrne or Rebecca Cooper or Liz Kendall?
I'm always interested in this line of argument because you do see it a lot. You're absolutely right. Because I just wonder whether it's an excuse a lot of people use to sort of back Jeremy, because I can't imagine who the candidate is. And maybe this is part of the point. Who is the candidate in the PLP that ultimately will make Jeremy Corbyn supporters go, well, that person is so inspiring and I'm convinced they're going to win so much that I'm prepared to sort of switch sides. I mean, the only person I can think about off the top of my head is Chukwuemunna, but you know, he's been a bit hesitant in the past and I guess would be portrayed at least as a sort of Blairite as well, wouldn't he?
Well, I think at the start of this campaign, we didn't know much about Owen Smith. We still don't know a huge amount about Owen Smith, but we didn't know much about him. And you could kind of say that maybe he is the next big thing. You don't necessarily know until they've kind of been put under that kind of scrutiny. You can think of various candidates who might be that thing. Like Lisa Nandy, for example, is someone who's been kind of put forward. But I think as it's kind of gone on, there have been several faux pas and sort of mistakes from the Smith camp as well as the Corbyn camp. Mm. So today, Corbyn has been sort of battered for his hashtag Traingate. But at the same time, Owen Smith has also been on the news for calling Corbyn a lunatic. Again, Smith tried to go out with his big policy platform a few weeks ago, but the headlines were about him saying he would smash Theresa May back on her heels. Mm. And there was also a kind of worrisome, leadsome moment where he said that he was ordinary because he has a wife and family, as opposed to his then Labour leadership candidate rival, the openly gay Angela Regal. So the question is Smith actually any more of a a strong candidate than Corbyn for the premiership, and how is that going to kind of play for
that would suggest that Corbyn that was that the way supporters. You phrased that would suggest that probably not, right? I mean, ultimately he's the person he gets defeated, and they have to look around for somebody else. I mean, Don, what's your
I've argued, you know, written in one blog or another, that defeatism is Jeremy Corbyn's secret weapon. Mm. It is like, well, you know, none of those three could win, so I might as well vote for Jeremy, who I believe in. You know, and now Owen Smith, well, he can't win, so I'm going to vote for Jeremy, even though I know, you know. So my view of him is he's on an incredibly steep learning curve. He did an interview on Today programme this morning where he dealt with the lunatic thing, which was unfortunate. I worked for a mental health charity, and anybody who kind of thinks that using any language like that is smart is wrong. But he said, you know, I'm learning to weigh carefully what I do. And I kind of think that's the difference. Mm-hmm. You know, being leader of the opposition, being a potential prime minister, is a really big, tough ask. Jeremy's never wanted the job, never looked as though he was preparing himself for it. I do think that Owen Smith is ambitious. And I love ambition if it's ambition for a purpose. I mean, I actually think of myself as a bit of a talent spotter. I heard him at Queen Mary College a couple of years ago, and I came back and I said to one of Sadiq Khan's people, you know, I just heard Owen Smith seemed very good to me. He said, oh, yeah, he's great. You know, he's on the left, but not yet. Mm. So, and you, I'm sure you can say not yet, but does he have the potential to develop? I think he does.
I suppose the other side is also he would actually, if he were to be no-cond, would actually resign, which isn't something you can be sure of for Jeremy Corbyn, or indeed if he lost the next general election.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, let's talk on the next general election. I mean, we're kind of merging two topics in this discussion, but that's fine. But Harry, your topic, you were looking at some analysis that Will Jennings had done, weren't you, in terms of leader sort of satisfaction ratings and what that then means. And I guess it's easy to forget, talking about the Labour membership and the Labour electorate, that there is a wider British electorate that's eventually going to have to decide if Jeremy Corbyn does indeed survive. I mean, what are some of the findings you've been looking at?
Yeah, so this is just, it's a very simple point, but it's a very neat graph put together by Will Jennings, which is the comparison between the Labour and Conservative leader approval scores and the eventual Labour versus Conservative vote share. It's basically, the higher the Labour satisfaction, especially in comparison with the Conservative leader satisfaction, the higher the Labour leader, the Labour actual result. It isn't terribly surprising, but does have a sort of nice correlation. There's about a correlation of 0.7 on there. What that would mean for Labour, were this to come through and were Corbyn's satisfaction to be now played out through into a general election, is if to go by the trend line, it would mean that Labour would lose by 17 points. They would go down in flames, sort of 1931 style.
So we're sort of talking 44% for the Tories, 27% for Labour, so thereabouts. Something, yeah, that's 17 points.
Which we have seen in some polls, haven't we? I mean, this is not like, you know, somebody's made this up. We've actually seen polling numbers, which are just,
not completely outside the realms of possibility. Obviously, the kind of question with it is the extent to which it is solely Corbyn's fault. So prior to what the Corbynites would call the Labour coup, what the Blairites or moderates or whatever would call the vote of no confidence in Jeremy Corbyn, he was already kind of down. He did have sort of low satisfaction scores, but not as low as he has now had since the EU referendum. This kind of fills into something else I was talking about with, which was something YouGov came out with, which is the reason why people who were voting Labour and now aren't changed their minds. And a third of the biggest reason, a third of the people said the reason was because of Jeremy Corbyn. Again, the question is that something which was triggered by the Labour right or moderates, or was it something which was inherent in there and there's just wants to make it clear that they don't support Jeremy Corbyn, might come back if Corbyn goes?
Mm. I mean, this is the problem, though, Don, really, isn't it? Is that ultimately it's impossible to extrapolate from the summer that we've had in British politics what the reason is for Labour's collapse in the polls. It's probably a combination of several factors, isn't it? For the Labour unity in the future, almost regardless of what happens to Jeremy Corbyn, you know, ultimately that split's going to be there. People that say, right, you launched a coup at the immediately after Brexit when the Tories were vulnerable and you've caused this commotion in the Labour Party, which has led to our decline in poll rating, versus people that say, come on, Jeremy Corbyn was useless and he, you know, was partially responsible for Brexit and, you know, he has no confidence in his MPs and therefore he should go. I mean, in terms of party unity, it's really hard to see how the Labour Party sort of stitches itself back together at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I was talking to a journalist today briefing this, and he says, well, what do you think is going to happen? And I said, it's a mess. I mean, let's get away from it. Whoever, takes over, even, if Owen wins, I hope he does, he's going to have a huge task. But in a sense, at least he sees that the problem is to unite the Labour Party in the country and at Westminster. Whereas the whole thrust of the Corbyn campaign is, we just represent the party in the country and we'll drive those stupid so-and-sos at Westminster with the threat of, So, I mean, if you want a proper unity, and I think it's just worth making this point, Labourers, the problem identified by John Cruddas in all of politics, we have to kind of make peace with the electorate. We have to, go and that's kind of been lost sight of. And I just don't think that would ever happen under a Corbyn leadership that will look outward. So we've lost a lot of time in doing that kind of, what policies we want, but which will work. And I just think there's more of a chance of that. Mm-hmm. Sensible reaching out, thinking about, Labour's values and how they can appeal. Because there are lots of things that are wrong with the country. It's not like it's all, that everything the Tories have done has been brilliant. There's lots of things to work on. Let's say rail. lots of things where there are ways in. But just as Ed Miliband showed with the energy freezes, that if you've got policies that are popular, if you are not regarded as somebody who will deliver them, then they're worth... they're worth nothing. Very so that for me is the task facing the union, and it's a huge task.
I mean, you several good points there. Of course, one of the things that is obviously going to dominate British politics in the immediate future is the sort of Brexit debate, if you like, and what form that takes, if indeed it happens. Owen Smith today is suggesting there should be a second referendum. My topic is on that subject because I'm fascinated by the why it happened, but also what happens next. And there's a couple of poll findings from YouGov that I'll take in turn. Maybe I'll introduce one and we talk about it, and then introduce another one and do the same. From a poll they conducted at the end of July, beginning of August, so it's a few weeks old, but still very interesting. And the first question I want to talk about looks at what people's attitudes are to the vote that took place. And people were given three options, I guess four if you include a don't know. And one was that they supported, I'm paraphrasing here for brevity, but one was that they supported leaving the EU and, still do, and the government should make that happen. And 45% of the sample said that. The second option of three was I did not support leaving the EU, but essentially now I think we should accept it and it should happen. And 24% thought that. So that's 69% thinking essentially one way or another that Brexit should happen and the government should make that happen. And 22%, the sort of passionate Remainers, if you like, who said they did not support leaving the EU and the government should ignore the result and seek to overturn it in a second referendum. I do wonder whether the ignore the result there is perhaps a bit leading. Mm-hmm. But there's 22% that agree with that. And I guess what this seems to suggest is that there is a large body of people that voted Remain that are ultimately accepting the result in one way or another. And to illustrate that a bit more, of the Remain voters in the sample, 49% said they did not support leaving the EU, but now the British people have voted to leave, the government has a duty to carry out their wishes and leave. And 45%, so basically a pretty even split amongst a sample size of 626, said that they did not support leaving the EU and that basically it shouldn't happen. And carrying on the Labour topic there's a pretty much a third, a third, a third split. Who needs more division in the Labour Party? But there's pretty much a third, a third, a third split on that issue. But there's also in this poll some discussion around what Brexit looks like. But we'll come to that a bit later. But the second question I think was also interesting is, do you think it would be acceptable or not for the government to call a second referendum asking if people still want to leave the EU? 34% said that would be acceptable. 56% said it would not be acceptable. So this feels like a country accepting Brexit. But Harry, what's your take on some of these polls?
So I think a lot of the polls, a lot of pollsters have asked this kind of question, is Regrexit a thing? Do people regret leaving, voting to leave the EU? People don't, basically. But that's also something that might change. And I do think that the ignore the result is something which would need another kind of question wording to see what would happen were somewhere down the line something significant to actually change. If we go into recession, what would happen kind of then? Mm-hmm. So there's kind of an ignore the result, and there's a... that's kind of one way of looking at it, and the other way would be if something has changed, do you think that we should now have a second referendum? I think that's kind of what Owen Smith has kind of been pushing as his issue is. We think that there should be this thing which, if and when something changes, if nothing else, then we naturally know what the alternative is. At the moment, Brexit means Brexit, but what Brexit means is still not very clear. When we actually know a little bit more about that, when there's more of an informed decision to be made, that might be something which I think both Labour MPs and Conservative MPs and supporters might be a much more support for.
Mm. Yeah. John, what's your take?
Well, I kind of think the real world is going to be important here. When I look at the three Brexit ministers, I kind of think, wow, what an odd trio. You know, and the idea that the three of them, you know, David Davis, who, you know, I remember when I was covering European summits for the BBC, he was the kind of the Minister of State who came and did all the media for you, you know. And I like, you know, very likable character, but he's kind of a bit past his sell-by date, I think. Liam Fox, the same. And what do you say about Boris? So this is a really strange grouping. And then the thing is, I blame Theresa May for Brexit. You know, she was the invisible Remain, you know, she sat on her hands. And if you want to blame anybody, you know, you can say, well, where was she? So Boris is derided for putting his career before country. What did she do, for God's sake?
She played the Gordon Brown approach, wasn't it? Yeah. A significant issue, and she sort of went missing.
Yeah, absolutely went AWOL, and I don't think she knows what to do. So, you know, the optimist in me, and I always try to be optimistic, is actually the Tory problems are really big and real. And so at some point there becomes a Labour opportunity. And I think Owen Smith's thing about the second referendum is, you know, not something you necessarily put absolutely front and centre. But I think it's helpful to him in the Labour leadership because, you know, the balance of opinion. But at some point you say, well, OK, they promised you money for the NHS. They promised they were going to, and they haven't delivered. So let's have another look at this. And I think, you know, there'll come a point at which that might be an attractive argument because people... It's very odd. They like referendums in, you know, you want a referendum, you know, on anything, they tend to say yes.
We want their say. I mean, the futures of, as you mentioned, is going to be really important to this. And this YouGov poll tries to get under the skin of some of that. And we can talk a bit about how difficult it is to do in a polling context, because I think that is an important point. But one of the questions talks about thinking about the British future outside of the European Union. How important, if at all, do you think it is that Britain has a free trade deal with the remainder of the European Union? 79% say that's important, and even 84% of Conservatives, which would appear to leave, you know, lead you towards a sort of single market solution, maybe not. But then there is also some much more complicated polling, which I want to spend some time explaining, because I think it's important, which... essentially on screen has descriptions of three different possible scenarios in which what Brexit could look like, and then asks whether or not this scenario would be good or bad for Britain or whether they didn't know. And they can be paraphrased as a hard Brexit, the Canadian option and the Norway option, with the hard Brexit being 32% thinking that's good for Britain, with the Canadian option 50% thinking that's good for Britain, and with the sort of Norway option, 35% thinking it's good for Britain. So a preference for the Canadian model there. But I think it's worth me reading out the descriptions, actually, because I think that's quite important. So the hard Brexit is that Britain leaves the EU and does not sign any new trade deal with the rest of the EU. Britain does not have automatic access to European markets, and there are tariffs or other barriers on many British exports. Britain has full control over our borders and immigration, does not have to follow any EU regulations, and does not have to contribute any money to the EU. And as I say, 32% think that would be good for Britain, 44% think it would be not good for Britain, and 25% don't know. And then to follow that with the so-called Canadian option, Britain leaves the EU and instead agrees a free trade deal with the EU, like Canada. Britain can export goods to the EU without paying tariffs, but the deal does not include services, so does not allow British industries like financial services to export freely to the EU. Britain has full control over our borders and immigration, does not have to follow any EU regulation, and does not have to contribute any money to the EU. Good for Britain, 50%. Not good for Britain, 24%. Don't know, 27%. And then finally, Britain, this is the sort of Norway option, if you like. Britain leaves the EU and instead joins EFTA, like Norway. Britain still has full trade access to EU markets. EU citizens would still have to have the right to live and work in Britain. Britain still has to follow EU regulations on the single market, but not on things like agriculture, fishing or home affairs. Britain has to make a financial contribution to the EU. Would be good for Britain, 35, would not, 38, don't know, 27. Now, quite a long-winded way of explaining some of those findings, but I do think it's quite important to read out the phrasing of that question. I mean, Harry, I'll come to you. It's a really difficult thing to do to sort of... I mean, it's a great effort to try and tease out what people actually expect and want from Brexit. But for me, there's two observations there. One is, I wonder what your thoughts are on naming countries as examples and what impact that might have. And the second thing is about this borders thing, because two of these solutions mention full control of immigration. And the sort of Canadian option in the middle with sort of a free trade agreement and control of borders, but not on services, seems to be the winner. But what's your take on some of this?
So I think the first thing to mention is obviously it's a quite long-winded question, which is inevitable. Like, it's a really difficult thing to try and get under the bonnet of. But at the same time, I think that's going to mean that some people are going to drift off by the end of it, and some people are going to say, Canada or Norway, which would you prefer to be? And that might be kind of part of it. I like the idea of being Canadian, so I'm going to float. I think that is possible. In terms of actually what it kind of means, I think so. When you say this important, very important, not at all important stuff about the free trade, I think if you ask the same question about immigration, you would 100% find that, even 100%, you would definitely find that there would be a big total important for immigration being controlled as well. If you give people the option of both, then they're going to take both. The problem is that that's not actually going to be on the table. And that's kind of, I think, what comes out of this. People don't really understand what services, the changes to services would mean. The only way you're going to kind of get at some of the detail on that might actually be in the case of a second referendum or something like that, where there's an awful lot of explaining and unpacking and different people and business leaders kind of coming together and saying this is what all of these different things mean, and in fact, if there isn't a second referendum, all of that stuff will just be happening behind the scenes with lobbies in sort of smoke-filled rooms, which might end up being something which is less satisfying.
I should add before I come to Don that if you look at some of the cross breaks here, Leave voters are most likely to think the Canadian option is good for Britain, interestingly, and Remain voters are most likely to think that the Norway option is good for Britain, perhaps unsurprisingly, but I think it is interesting that Leave voters prefer the Canadian option to the hard Brexit, which may be something for the Conservative right to think about. But Don, what's your perspective on some
of these? Let's go back to the real world. I'm not sure, one of the things is how long has it taken Canada to negotiate this deal? Quite a long time, several years. So is that a realistic option? And when the Norwegians have been asked, do you want Britain to kind of come into your little grouping? They said, no, we're a group of small countries. We do not want a monster country like Britain coming. So I think in the real world, these are, kind of not actually options. There will have to be, when it comes to it, a British model. And I just can't see the city, all those financial kind of institutions who are important to the Tory. They're not as important as they were. Hedge fund people are telling me. But I just do think business, being in the single market is just fantastically important, and whatever it takes to do that in the end will be what happens. And I think the real area of movement, of looking for change, is going to be in the area of some deal on free movement, some sort of time limit on it, or an emergency break. You know, I mean, my sense is, but in campaigning terms, there's a lot for Labour to be doing to say, you know, look, we should be shadowing, you know, the social measures, you know, all sorts of things that are going on, environmental things. You know, we want to stay as close to what we had that were good for British people as we possibly can. So Theresa May, don't just, you know, say Brexit is Brexit and you don't give a damn about these things. No, we should be following all the good things that Europe has delivered to us. And I think there's, you know, I think there is an audience there for Labour if they make that positive case about staying as close to Europe as possible. Yeah, we accept Brexit, but Brexit must not mean that we throw the baby out with the bathwater.
In terms of the importance of sort of public opinion on this as well, I think it's important to note the historic weakness of Labour at the moment. It means that actually there's a huge amount more leeway than Theresa May has kind of hoped for in some ways, in that she can probably go get whatever deal she actually ends up with. She probably can feel confident going into a general election that she won't be booted out, and she can kind of go with this. Here is my pledge. This is what we're actually going to go for in the end. Mm. And this is...
Her problem may very well be her own side, of course, because, I mean, most Conservative leaders seem to end in failure due to Europe.
As always, but...
There's plenty of scope for that here, isn't there?
There is, but there's, I think, two elements there, which one is that the Conservative Party obviously has a huge instinct for survival, and they kind of know... I think that you trust them more than Labour to, in the midst of on the way to a general election, to actually sort of keep together and sort of go along with it if the alternative is going with both parties basically disintegrating, and risk for them like the ultimate defeat, which would be Corbyn going into Downing Street, and I think that would mean that the likelihood is, if there is a general election, and if Theresa May has a line which is vote for me and we'll do this, then whatever she says will go.
Final word to Don. I mean, you know, Owen Smith's talked a little bit about, you know, how there should be a second referendum and so on and so forth. But presumably, as Harry mentions, a lot of this is contingent upon Labour being anywhere near in a position to make that happen, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so, you know, what would need to happen is that the Theresa May bounce, you know, runs out of, you know, some of the gas goes out of the ball, and that Owen Smith gets a bounce, so that we get back to, you know, some normal kind of numbers, which would be, you know, both parties in the 30s. You know, that may seem like the stuff of dreams now, but that's kind of where we've been for, you know, for quite a long time. So the Tory party... you know, pre-bounce, you know, 36.9% at the general election and 24% at the overall, you know, they're not in a historically super position, you know. So as events develop, if we get, you know, another recession, I'd say lots of ifs, but it is possible to see a Labour recovery into the low 30s, the Tories coming down to mid 30s, and then we are back, you know. You know, we're in contention again.
We're in the last couple of minutes, so very quickly to wrap up, do either of you see there being a possibility in Parliament rejecting Brexit? I mean, I don't know what the mechanics of Article 50 actually are, whether there needs to be an act of Parliament, but presumably with the Tory majority quite small, that's a possibility, isn't it, Harry? What do you think?
So there was obviously some lawyers, I think, tried to take this to court. I don't know what's kind of happened with that. I think it's presumably still there. But... I think that the likelihood is that if Brexit, we don't know if Brexit will happen. Were Brexit to, or Brexit with, as in invoking Article 50, and leaving the EU in whatever guise that kind of takes. And there's so many ifs on the way to that it's basically impossible to say if it ends up being a kind of well-negotiated, amicable split where we end up with some kind of freedom of movement break in exchange for more money to the EU budget or something. Then, and you can actually see where there are some other countries are sort of supportive of of that kind of, or at least the public are, they're the likes of the Five Star Movement or Geert Wilders or whoever, that would appease those kind of people. You can see that kind of happening and everyone being as happy as they're possible or possibly can be about it. If it ends up being something sort of really contentious, then it's likely to be a general election and all sorts of horrors happening before then.
Yeah, I mean, I think Theresa May's, you know, I think somebody said that three quarters of MPs were against Brexit. You know, there's a very solid pro-European majority across the Commons, partly because of the Scottish Nationalists, you know, and Labour. And, you know, so any sort of hard Brexit, any stupid Brexit, yeah, is going to get short shrift there. And as they find it difficult to come up with a deal, you know, I think there are lots of possibilities for the whole May thing to unravel. And if the economy, you know, starts going south, then hey, you know.
Well, all bets are certainly off. Lots to keep an eye out for in the coming months and probably years, let's be honest. Don, Brendan, Harry Carr, thanks very much for joining me. That's all we've got time for this week's Political Betting and Polling Matters podcast. Keep an eye out for me next week as I'm in New York City and I may well have a guest or two to be talking about events over there. Let's get some American accents on the show and sort of put us straight in terms of whether the Donald really can fight back and become president or whether Hillary's got it sewn up. Keep an eye out for that next week. You've been listening to the politicalbetting.com Polling Matters podcast, which is brought to you by the Podbean podcast app. The Podbean podcast app is the top podcast app around. You can get instant updates of your new favourite podcasts directly to your Podbean podcast app. It's free, easy to use, and lets you easily discover new podcasts that you love and also publish your own podcast too. Whether you use an Android device or an iPhone device, this app is the app for you. So get the new Podbean podcast app today on Google Play or Apple App Store. Enjoy more from the podcast that you love.